From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, one of Canada's most acclaimed writers, Alice Munro. She's known for her ability to evoke the rich detail of ordinary life in the small towns of Ontario. Then we remember Maurice Levine. For more than a quarter of a century, he was the artistic director of the celebrated Lyrics and Lyricists series in New York City. He died on Monday. And we remember former Beatles press agent Derek Taylor, who also died this week. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new videotape series that captures what would be the forerunner to today's musical videos. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The nomination of William Weld as ambassador to Mexico suffered a new blow today when Senator Jesse Helms convened a meeting of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee but refused to allow a hearing. Weld was in the room for the meeting but was given no opportunity to speak. At a White House news conference, President Clinton said he was disappointed that Weld would not get a hearing, and for the first time he urged the Senate to circumvent Helms' effort to squelch the nomination.
I believe the full Senate should find a way to move forward on this nomination, and I am encouraged by suggestions that senators are seeking a way within the rules of the Senate to do so. After all, a majority of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee wants him to have a hearing, a majority of the United States Senate wants him to have a hearing, and all I have asked for is a fair hearing and an up or down vote on a man I believe to be highly qualified.
The president has rejected a suggestion by Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott to withdraw Weld's nomination. The spacecraft Mars Global Surveyor is orbiting the red planet at this hour, getting ready to make the first complete high-resolution map of Mars. The map will be used to guide other spacecraft to the most likely spots to find signs of life. Surveyor completed its 10-month, 435-million-mile journey last night. Its main rocket fired on time. 22 minutes later, Surveyor was in an elliptical orbit, and in a few days, Surveyor will begin aerobraking, dipping into the Martian atmosphere to trim its orbit near a circle around Mars' poles, up about 234 miles. Editors of a newspaper sold on the streets by people who are homeless are joining forces. The so-called street paper editors are meeting in Seattle to form the North American Street Newspaper Association. From member station KPLU, Paula Whistle reports.
There are now about 30 street papers in U.S. and Canadian cities. The new association will provide technical assistance and help new ones get started. There's already a similar association in Europe. Advocates of the street paper movement say it's a way to help the poor help themselves. Many papers are run and sold by the homeless and focus on issues concerning life on the streets. Tim Harris edits Real Change in Seattle. He says because the papers are sold to all kinds of people, they could change the political landscape.
Street newspapers can be a kind of a backbone for a revitalized poor people's movement.
He says the goal of the new association is to have street papers in every major city. For NPR News, I'm Paula Whistle in Seattle.
10 retired four-star generals, including former Secretary of State Alexander Haig, today urged President Clinton to reject a proposed treaty that would ban the use of landmines. In an open letter to the president, the four-star officers say the treaty produced by a multinational conference in Oslo is clearly defective and could put U.S. troops at risk. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 25 points. This is NPR News. Producer prices have gone up for the first time this year. Prices paid by wholesalers rose 0.3% in August because of higher costs for vegetables and gasoline. A study in New Jersey raises questions about the value of cutting off extra benefits to welfare mothers who have more children. The research was done by professors at Rutgers University. Gene Dillard reports.
4 years ago, New Jersey became the first state in the country to deny additional benefits to women on public assistance who had more babies. The policy is now in effect in 20 other states as well. The study shows that although the birth rates among welfare mothers dropped substantially in New Jersey between 1993 and 1995, there's no evidence the decline resulted from the so-called family cap. Nevertheless, State Human Services Commissioner William Waldman defends the policy, saying it teaches welfare mothers to be more responsible in making family planning decisions. He says the policy will be continued in New Jersey and probably other states as well.
Most states who have done it that I've talked to adopted the policy because of the message, and the message of personal responsibility, not the desire to either save money or to reduce the birth rate.
The family cap provision was upheld by the federal courts following a constitutional challenge by the American Civil Liberties Union. For NPR News, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
The head of the Texas Board of Education says it might be cheaper and more innovative to buy kids laptop computers and CD-ROMs than to pay for textbooks. The statement comes as the state considers the possibility of spending nearly $2 billion on textbooks over the next 6 years. Education Board Chairman Jack Christie says computer companies might be willing to give the state discounts and donated services for a chance to serve 4 million school children. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR member stations and the Pew Charitable Trusts for in-depth coverage of the arts, cultural issues, and religion.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Canadian short story writer Alice Munro is sometimes described as North America's Chekhov. She's celebrated for her ability to evoke the spirit of a place, most often the small towns of southwestern Ontario where she grew up and still lives today. Many of her readers simply refer to the region as Alice Munro Country. One critic says of her stories that they're telling portraits of ordinary people living simple lives in a complex way. Munro is the author of one novel and 8 collections of short fiction, including The Beggar Maid, Friend of My Youth, and Open Secrets. Her latest collection, Selected Stories, is due out in paperback this fall. It draws on the work of her entire career. When I spoke with Alice Munro last November, she said she already knew she wanted to be a writer when she was 10 years old.
I was reading all these books, and I think one day I thought, I didn't want to leave the stories behind. And the way that they wouldn't be shut up in a book and left behind was that I would make up one of my own, and then I would always have it in my head. And so I began to make up stories that were actually very like whatever I happened to be enthralled with in reading at the moment. And so I would always, this wasn't writing anything down, but this was, I remember doing it when I was in about grade 7, having a historical novel that was patterned on some stuff I'd been reading. And then I can remember, all sorts of things that I was writing in my head in high school. And then I think when I got to be about 15, I started trying to write some of them down, and it was a dreadful disappointment how hard it was and how nothing really came out on the page the way I wanted it to.
Well, you went to college. You got married right out of college.
That's right. I didn't graduate. I had a 2-year scholarship. And as I said, there was no money to go further. So after 2 years, I got married. I was 20.
How much did you write when your children were young?
You'd be surprised how much I managed. I'm surprised now when I think about it. I tried something almost every day. My children took naps. Naps were very important in our family. And then after a while, they went to school. And I would try, but I had to tear up most of the things I wrote. And this wasn't really a matter of being a housewife and a mother of small children and not having enough time. It was simply a matter of learning my craft, which took me a long time.
I'm thinking of a quote from one of the characters in your stories that spoke to me as a parent. In my own house, you write, I seem to be often looking for a place to hide, sometimes from the children, but more often from the jobs to be done and the phone ringing and the sociability of the neighborhood. I wanted to hide so that I could get busy at my real work, which was a sort of wooing of distant parts of myself. What form did that wooing of distant parts of yourself take?
You know what it is? It's just sitting and looking at the wall or looking out the window, usually with a cup of coffee going cold beside me. And it's not really trance-like or anything like meditation. My word for it to the children, my husband, is just, I'm thinking. But I'm not really thinking in a logical way. I am just trying to get some feeling, picture, necessity to come straight in my head. And that is one of the hardest things to do because you look like you're not doing anything.
That's exactly right. And guilt and parenting, they go together. But and I hope you don't take this wrong. I would think that if you were, say, a scientist who went off from the family to discover the cure for cancer, that's one thing. But writing seems to induce so much guilt. It's so literally self-centered.
Because it's literally self-centered. It also may come to nothing. It's not like a job you have. And it's very hard to justify. But I think it's particularly hard to justify for women. I know lots of male writers who at the same stage that I was at would have actually a room in the house where they went and did this business. And everybody would sort of make sure that Dad wasn't disturbed. But generally, there was a wife who was holding the fort. And for women, there isn't any setup like this. And there also isn't in women of my generation. There tends not to be the feeling that this is what you deserve. I still find it hard to think that I deserve that time.
To this day. One critic referred to your writing as gossip informed by genius.
I know.
Well, I can understand you enjoying the genius part of that.
I enjoy the gossip part, too.
Well, what about the gossip? Do you like that description of your writing? What is that
word?
Yes,
I think I do, because, of course, it's redeemed by the genius. If it had been called gossip, I might have been rather huffy. But gossip, there's a pretty wide interpretation for gossip, isn't there? There can be very malicious gossip, which is actually spreading rotten and perhaps untrue stories about people. And there can be gossip, and I think women have done this always, in which you get together and you simply try to figure out life. You talk about your sister-in-law's divorce or somebody's problems with their mother-in-law or something, but it's trying to analyze what people are like, what people say and what they think, which may be different things, and gathering in all the evidence you have for this. You listen to women on the train or on the bus. When I say that women gossip, I'm not using it as a pejorative thing at all. I think this is something we've always done. We try to make sense of the world around us or to record it, and generally in terms of human relationships.
Are you the kind of person who always knows what's going on in your town?
Yes. And when I was a young wife and mother and I had friends who were in the same situation, we would get together maybe about once a week, and we'd drink endless cups of coffee and smoke endless cigarettes, because you did in those days, and just tell the truth about everything. I suppose it could be called gossip, but mostly it was hilarious. And I think, we laughed all the time, even though what we were talking about was probably disappointment and frustration things that didn't make us particularly happy. But we were together, and we were sharing all this stuff. And we were enormously helpful to each other, I think.
You've written series of short stories that share the same characters, and a reader can trace a character's development through the stories. Why didn't you make those stories into a novel? Or what's the difference for you between writing these short fiction and a novel?
You know, I really don't know. I really don't know. I used to try to write novels because, you know, when I started out writing, what you did was write a few short stories until you sort of got on your feet, and then you wrote a novel. And that's what I thought I should do, and it was also what publishers thought I should do. And I tried and tried and tried, and something always went wrong. I got bored with the novel. Things got flabby. And I didn't feel the right tension. I feel very tense about short stories, just as if you're on a tightrope or if there's a rope pulling you somewhere. And I didn't get that feeling when I tried to write novels. I did write Lives of Girls and Women, which is a very episodic sort of novel, and it's the usual thing about, you know, growing up, childhood, and adolescence. And I could only do that after I got it chopped into very distinct segments and could do it that way. So I was it was almost like working at a series of stories. And this may have something to do with the fact that when I was a young mother, I couldn't possibly take a year out of my life to write a novel. I could take a month to write a story and then, you know, catch up on all the things I'd let go. But it got to be my habit, and it got to be the only way I can now write fiction. And yet the stories are very untidy stories. They tend to have a lot of, different pathways, and I try to, I don't try to, but I find myself shaping them in ways that are rather strange. So what I'm doing now, I guess, is writing ever longer stories.
Do you ever fear that at the end of your career, you'll have all of these stories, but it will feel to you as if they're bits and pieces of things?
You know, that's what Catherine Mansfield said. She said how awful it would be to die. Of course, she died when she was 32, I think. And she said how terrible to leave all these bits and pieces. And I used to think of that quite a bit, but I don't now, because stories I've found can have a longer life than novels. If they're picked up for anthologies, they keep alive. And then a book of stories may be reissued just as easily as a novel. And that doesn't worry me at all anymore. I think of each story as the main, while I'm doing it, it's the main work of my life. And I can hardly remember what I used to write before I started doing it. And then when I'm finished with it, it goes out there and joins all these other offspring, and I hardly think of it again. So I guess I don't think in terms of what I'm going to leave behind or what my reputation is. I'm always just thinking of the work I'm doing right now.
I'm thinking of one of the characters in your story, Material. She reads a short story by her ex-husband, who she never thought would turn out to be a decent writer.
And that's right.
And the story affects her very deeply, and she's envious that he can, I think in the character's words, turn a lifetime of memories into art, while for her they're just useless baggage. Now, I imagine this is bitterness talking, that this character...
Yes, I think it's bitterness, because I think it's because of her particular experience with that man that she feels this way. I don't for one minute think that people envy me for turning a lifetime of experience into art or into stories. Because I think that's what I was talking about before, that's what the women on the bus are doing. That's what women in kitchens are doing. And I think men do it, too. My husband is a World War II veteran, and I know when I listen to his friends that I feel that they are creating life stories.
You called your stories entertainments at one
yes.
point. Is that exactly what you mean, that they come lightly?
I want them to be entertaining. Nothing bothers me worse than being written about as a bleak or grim writer, and it happens. And I don't intend this, because I can be entertained by a very serious story. Anything that surprises me, that makes me see anything differently, anything that gives me a gift, is entertaining. It lightens my spirits. It makes me happier. That's what I think art does for people. And I think what is thought of as serious art can do this perhaps more readily than art which sets out to be frivolous.
Alice Munro's latest collection, Selected Stories, is due out in paperback this fall. This is Fresh Air. Latino Video has just released a series of four home videos featuring musical shorts made by Paramount Pictures from 1929 to 1941. Some are just filmed concerts. But even those, says classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, are fascinating historical documents.
Long before anyone ever dreamed up MTV, there were the 1930s equivalent of music videos, short films that played in movie theaters before the main feature. Musical stars of the day made them, like Ruth Etting and Lillian Roth, whose scandalous lives Hollywood would film decades later, or Bing Crosby, who's in two comic shorts produced by Keystone Cops director Max Sennett. Composers like Hoagy Carmichael, the delightfully roly-poly Mack Gordon and his partner Harry Revel, or Duke Ellington in his first screen appearance, perform some of their own songs. There are precious films of black entertainers like Louis Armstrong, Cab Calloway, or a teenaged Billie Holiday with traces of baby fat still visible. The great Bessie Smith made her only film appearance in a brief 1929 melodrama called St. Louis Blues that her singing raises to a kind of tragic grandeur. And a 1941 short has Fats Waller doing his freest, most delicious version of Ain't Misbehavin'.
No one to talk with all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. Ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you. You fine rascal, you. I know for certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you, just you. Like Jack Horner in a corner, don't go nowhere.
What do I care? Your kisses, my dear, are worthwhile waiting for. Believe me, dear.
Don't stay out late, ain't got no place to go. I'm home about eight, just me and my radio. Hey, misbehaving, saving all my love for you.
Studios also use these films to get audience reactions to new personalities. In Office Blues, an irresistible pre-blonde Ginger Rogers moons over her passive boss. I am cynical, he's rabbinical, she sings. Cary Grant made his film debut in a musical short called Singapore Sue. Some of these films tell little stories, often about some form of sexual abuse to women. Some of these films are startlingly experimental. Just before her Broadway debut in 1930, Ethel Merman made a short called Her Future, in which she stands before a judge in a malevolently distorted Kafkaesque courtroom and promises to reform. If I've gone wrong, then heaven will judge me, for I learn the game from men, she sings, then belts out one of the hit tunes of the day, Sing, You Sinners. Perhaps the most impressive and imaginative of these mini-musicals is Duke Ellington's Symphony in Black, in which director Fred Waller cross-cuts back and forth from Ellington composing this jazz symphony and performing it in concert to powerful images of coal workers, a jilted woman, Billie Holiday, getting knocked to the ground by her ex-lover, and some exuberantly filmed sequences in a Harlem nightclub. I'm especially crazy about a 1929 film called Makers of Melody, in which Richard Rodgers and Lorenz Hart, playing themselves, send up the usual trashy interviews about how they came to write their hit songs.
Gentlemen, you're about to be interviewed.
Wait till I fix my tie.
Don't you like being interviewed?
Well, I don't mind, as long as you don't ask us which we write first, the words or the music.
I'm not going to ask you that. I think our readers will be more interested in knowing how you get the ideas.
You tell her, Larry.
Oh, no, you tell her, Dick.
Suppose you tell me how you began.
Have you got 2 or 3 days to listen?
Yes, if you tell it to Mr. Rogers' music.
Laugh that off, Hart.
It's a long, heart-rending story.
Yes.
What a beautiful, tough, hard-hearted town it is.
What? Oh, Manhattan.
Manhattan. Manhattan. We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx, and Staten.
The satirical scenes are punctuated by 3 enchanting musical numbers, Manhattan, The Girlfriend, and Blue Room. The extremely charming and stylish performers make today's young singers seem plodding and inert. How can you resist a film in which a lively flapper, more libidinously uninhibited than her boyfriend, sings, "He's very short on looks, but long on decency. He's long on decency. He's very tame. But he has made an awful hit with me since he, a hit with me since he first came. Isn't he cute? Isn't he sweet? He's gentle and mentally nearly complete. He's warm as an oven. He knows how to love. And I'm the girlfriend." That's funnier and sexier than anything I've ever seen on MTV.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a series of musical shorts on Kino Video. Here's Cab Calloway in his 1934 short, Jitterbug Party. This is Fresh Air.
Now, if you like to be a jitterbug, first thing you do, get yourself a jug. Put whiskey, wine, and gin within. Shake it all up and then begin. Get yourself a cup from start to toss. Come on, Jack, you drinking jitter sauce. Don't you worry, you just bug, you'll always be a jitterbug. See this gang, so for long, been jitterbug since the day they were born. The sauce is right, I swear they're gonna drink it till they die. Bring the whistle and blow the bell. Oh, boogie, what you done for tell? Come on, you just stop your mugging. Come on, be a jitterbug. It's the call of the jitterbug.
It's the call of the jitterbug.
It's the call of the jitterbug.
It's the call of the jitterbug.
It's the call of the jitterbug.
It's the call of the jitterbug.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember Maurice Levine, the founder of New York City's popular Lyrics and Lyricists series, a program that celebrated the lyrics and writers of musical theater. And looking back at the Beatles, we feature a 1987 interview with Derek Taylor, who passed away on Sunday.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. On today's archive edition, we remember Maurice Levine, who died Monday of complications following a stroke. He was the artistic director of the 92nd Street Y's hugely popular Lyrics and Lyricists music series, which he began in 1970. Here's the very first guest Levine featured in the series, Yip Harburg, singing one of the beloved songs he wrote for The Wizard of Oz.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true.
Many of the great lyricists who once appeared on the series are also no longer with us. That's why Levine often presented scripted shows saluting them. When Terry spoke with Maurice Levine last December, he told her that when he was invited to launch the series, he was working as a conductor on Broadway. He couldn't think of an interesting angle for the program until he spoke with Yip Harburg. Harburg shared some great songwriting stories, and Levine thought that's exactly what he should present on stage.
He gave me an example of one particular song of his, which really sticks in my mind. And that was Brother Can Spare a Dime. And he said, suppose I had written, my wife is sick, she just broke her leg, we're waiting for the doctor to come, Brother Can Spare a Dime. My kid's not doing so well, he's got diabetes. And they think he has a heart problem, Brother Can Spare a Dime. And go on and tell all the terrible things that were happening to people he knew, members of his family. He said, how long do you think people would listen to that? And I said, not very long, because it's just a recital of some terrible, terrible things. So he said, what I did write about was a man who was devoted to his country, who did all that was asked of him. And when he had done it all, his hands were empty. And he is confused. And, you know, once he built the railroad, made it run, made it race against time, and he finished it, and he got nothing for it. So you get this sense of a very sympathetic character and one who feels that he hasn't gotten a very good deal, as it were, from his own country. So he's confused. Brother Can Spare a Dime is the song of a confused, dedicated American. And that's a lyric.
So you presented Yip Harburg as the first person in the Lyrics and Lyricists series.
Yeah.
How did it go over?
It was a smash. And, I must say that when we had the whole idea of doing Lyrics and Lyricists at all, we thought, who could come to this kind of program? And we were thinking of 125 folding chairs in the art gallery would be about enough. And then in the last moment, we said, oh, what the heck, let's go for the big auditorium, which seats over 900. And it was our first program, and we didn't do badly at all. We had over 600 people, which was a pretty good turnout for our first event. What we didn't count on, or had no way of knowing, was that the press went crazy about the program. And by about 2 days later, there were lines around the corner for the box office. And we were smack sold out. And we've been sold out ever since.
Well, I love to hear the stories behind the songs. So I thought I'd play Alan J. Lerner, the lyricist, talking at your Lyrics and Lyricists series about writing the lyric for the song On the Street Where You Live for the show My Fair Lady. And Frederick Lowe was his songwriting partner, of course, on this show. So here's the story behind On the Street Where You Live.
When we were writing Fair Lady, and we had this character, Freddie Einstein Hill, who was supposedly a threat to Higgins, and yet he didn't have much footage in the play. So it was decided that we'd better write a kind of a large song for him to try and make his presence felt. And we wrote this song this way. Well, Fritz hated it. From the very beginning, he hated it, and it made it very difficult for me to talk to him about it because I had lots of problems with the lyrics. I wrote the lyrics, first of all, incorrectly on purpose. The lyrics should be, I have often walked down the street before, ba-da-da-da, my feet before, da-da-da-da-da, eat before. It should be that way. But it's a bore. Every time I spoke to him about it, he said, let's take it out. And I said, well, no, let's not take it out. I like the melody. So I couldn't talk to him about it. So I finally decided that I would interrhyme it in the middle, let enchantment pour out of every door, but I would try and find words so soft that maybe nobody would notice it. And so that's what happened. I have often walked down the street before, but the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before. All I want some eyes, Errol's eyes, high, knowing I'm, and so on. And it was literally done for oars and those kind of words, hoping that it would all slide by, and that would be that. When Columbia Records, who was making the album, and Mitch Miller at that time was the A&R man at Columbia, and he heard the song, and he loved the song, he said, but I hate that middle part. So Fritz, I don't care what you do with it, do anything you want with it. He hated it. So Mitch suggested that we take out the middle. Fritz was delighted. The less of it, the better. So it was taken out. I said, let's leave in the one part, because I did like the fact, the only thing I did like was that it was, oh, the towering feeling, just to know, because those first long notes all rhyme, which nobody knew, but it was attractive vocally. So finally the play opened in New Haven, and the song was an absolute disaster. And the night after we opened, everybody met and said, let's take it out, change the singer, get a new song, the usual thing that goes on. But I still liked the song. And I couldn't understand why it was dying the way it was. Finally, one day, I began to wonder, after playing it about three or four nights and looking at it, I began to wonder if everybody was in Ascot Grays, and I was wondering whether anybody remembered him from the scene previous, you know? And I thought, well, perhaps if we change the verse and put the verse more in the style of what just happened, that maybe there'll be some shock of recognition. And to fortify that, I'll have somebody open the door and say who he is. So I said to Moss, can we try that? So Moss said, well, yes, you could try that if you wanted to. And so help me, the next night it stopped the show. And Moss came around to see me afterwards, and he said, how dare you give me an inferiority complex? So this is the way the song then finally appeared in the show when it came to New York.
When she mentioned how her aunt bit off the spoon, she completely done me in, and my heart went on a journey to the moon. When she told about her father and the gin, and I never saw a more enchanting farce than the moment when she shouted, move your bloomin'!
Yes, sir.
Is Miss Doolittle at home?
Whom shall I say is calling?
Freddie Eynsford Hill.
Oh, yes, sir.
And if she doesn't remember me, tell... tell her I'm the fella who was sniggering at her.
Yes, sir.
And you needn't rush. I want a drink in this street where she lives.
Yes, sir.
I have often walked down the street, but the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before. All at once am I several stories high, knowing I'm on the street where you you may suddenly appear. People stop and stare, they don't bother me, for there's nowhere else on earth that I would rather be. Let the time go by, I won't care if I can be here.
That's Alan J. Lerner from his 1971 appearance at the Lyrics and Lyricists series at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. By the way, the singer we heard was J.T. Cromwell. Do you have a favorite lyric, or can you tell us what one of your favorite lyrics is?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. Like asking a parent with 10 children, which is your favorite of the 10? Gosh, I thought Night and Day is one of the great lyrics.
And what do you like about it?
I'll tell you what I like about it. In my estimation, it is the most passionate love song ever written. Can I do just a line or two from Night and Day?
I was hoping you'd ask.
Night and Day, under the height of me, there's such a hungry yearning, burning inside of me, and my torment won't be through until you let me spend the rest of my life making love to you day and night, night and day. That's a pretty good lyric.
Morris Levine spoke with Terry Gross last December. He died Monday at the age of 79. Several of the lyrics and lyricist's music series are available on CD on DRG Records.
Night and day, you are the one. Only you beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you. Night and day, day and night, why is it so that this longing for you follows wherever I go? In the roaring traffic's boom, in the silence of my lonely room, I think of you. Night and day, night and day, under the height of me, there's an oh such a hungry yearning burning inside of me. And its torment won't be through till you let me spend my life making love to you day and night, night and day.
Coming up, we remember an early friend and colleague of the Beatles. This is Fresh Air. Derek Taylor, a publicity spokesman for the Beatles, died Sunday at the age of 65 of cancer. He was the group's press agent in the mid-60s and then returned in the late 60s as press agent for the Beatles' company, Apple Corps. In between, Derek Taylor lived on the West Coast, where he did publicity for acts like the Byrds, Captain Beefheart, Judy Collins, and the Mamas and the Papas. Derek Taylor is the author of two memoirs, As Time Goes By and 50 Years Adrift, as well as an oral history of the Summer of Love, called It Was 20 Years Ago Today. Terry Gross spoke with Derek Taylor in 1987. She asked him to refresh our memories of what the Beatles were like in 1964, when he first started working for them.
Well, when I saw them first, it was in 63, they already had hits, and they were famous in Europe, and still fulfilling old contracts, playing cinemas and things. I was a newspaper man for then 15 years, and so stunned by the immediacy of these people's personalities. It wasn't so much the music, though that was fascinating. My wife and I saw that this was an exotic Liverpool adventure, and we were from Liverpool, living in Manchester. And I decided I would concentrate on covering their activities, and I was still supposed to be covering ballet in the theatre and low comedians and vaudeville, but of course it became almost obsessive covering the Beatles, because as I escalated my coverage for the Daily Express, so they were starting to get more and more famous. The Royal Show followed that year. They came to America in February 64. My newspaper did not send me to cover the trip. They used the American correspondent instead. It was then I decided I had to join them. If I was going to get on the trip, I had to be with them.
So they were already pretty famous.
Oh, yes.
By the time you joined.
Yes, I wasn't a publicist when I joined them. I was a journalist. So I didn't have to make them famous. But the job was to try and manipulate time. available time around these available Beatles, so that you'd got a line of people with no real rights, datebook magazine reporters, young people who'd clipped out coupons and said they were newspaper reporters who weren't, and then the Time magazine and the Saturday Evening Post over there. Murray the K's had enough time. Hang on there, I'll deal with you in a moment, Murray. Ringo can talk there because these people are after Ringo. And generally speaking, try and keep them in circulation because I believe they should have been shared. They should be shared out. At the same time, you couldn't make them available all the time. And we tried to make the press conferences into an art form so that they were fun too.
You didn't stay on for very long the first time that you signed up as the Beatles press agent.
Job
Why
was
did
intolerable.
You leave?
Intolerable. Mm-hmm. But it was.
So you kind of fell out of love with the Beatles.
I fell out of love with the job. The job was ridiculous.
Did the Beatles put impossible demands on you?
You know, the mental strain of staying up with these four buzzing people was exhausting. It was just too much. And I had four children.
You stayed in touch with the Beatles while you moved to the West Coast.
Yes.
And ended up promoting other rock groups and performers in California. But as you stayed in touch with the Beatles, did you change as they changed? And what I'm thinking here is, did you, for instance, start smoking and dropping acid at just about the same time?
No,
that they
I was
did?
Always behind them. Really, I was behind them. And one of the things they taught me first, perhaps more important than anything, and what everyone else got from them was you should never be afraid not to know. I mean, they showed great courage in ignorance. If you asked them something they didn't know, they said, I don't know. George says in a book we did together, one of our strengths was we didn't know Hedda Hopper was important. If we'd known all those people were important, we'd never have had the gall to do the things we did. So in other words, they simplified my complicated life. They taught me, you know, the importance of a fresh kind of an honesty, which I'd always held back. I was always impetuous and frank, but they taught me, they freed me from that. And then we had the cannabis, or marijuana, hash. That took us another level away from mundanity. Then they had LSD, and I had LSD, which they gave me.
They turned you on?
Yeah.
What was
David
that?
Crosby
what was...
gave me cannabis.
Uh-huh. What's that?
And then they, George and John gave Joan and me both LSD and RT in 67.
What was that day like? Did you know that you were
taking
LSD?
Yes, I knew. Well, I didn't know that I was taking LSD, quote-unquote, what it would mean. I didn't know I'd see the Scarlet Pillars and the Chartres Cathedral and all that stuff and the barbed wire growing in the window of the limo trick.
Right.
But you don't see that. Nothing happens twice. But I knew we were in for the big one sort of thing. And we were in the best of company. I knew enough about Leary to know that it was a set and setting situation. If you took it in the right mood and the right people, that would probably be all right.
What did you do that day, the first time you got high on acid and you were with the Beatles? Did you listen to records?
We sat at the piano and sang old songs until we cracked up at how badly I was playing, and we had a lot of fun.
Derek Taylor speaking with Terry Gross in 1987. We'll hear more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Back to Terry Gross's 1987 interview with Derek Taylor. He was the publicist for the Beatles in the 1960s.
You left the Beatles in 64. You returned to them in late 67, early 68 to be the head of publicity for Apple Records. You've described Apple as something that was set up to administer to the Beatles' desire to save the world.
Yes,
elaborate on that?
Yes. The idea was that... that the promulgated idea was to set up physically a place where anyone could come. And if they weren't there, then I would be there with someone like me. And you'd say, I want to write a play, I want to make a film about a cup of tea. And we would say, here's the money, go and do it. And to make sure everyone knew, they went on the Johnny Carson show with Tallulah Bankhead and Joe Garagiola and announced this to an expectant nation who were delighted to hear this. I mean, practically everyone would like to do something. So, and they all arrived in England. All these people arrived in England saying, let's go, man. Where's this money?
And you were responsible, right, for all those people who showed up?
I was there every day, and I was working at, you know, sort of office hours, 9 to 5. So were they at the beginning. So were the Beatles. But they soon tired of this adventure.
Who were some of the more lunatic people that showed up at your door?
Well, I mean, I don't want to say that the Hell's Angels were lunatics, but these people could be difficult and eccentric. They were not formal, conventional folk. And George dropped a memo in one day, which is it's been one of the books accurately quoted. And it said, while in San Francisco, I met some very nice fellows who were in the Hell's Angels, and I asked them over, when they come, please tell the staff not to be frightened and treat them well. I mean, this is the heavy chapter, and they did indeed arrive with their bikes and with Ken Kesey and with the people they call their old ladies, the women.
So what'd you do?
Put them up, took them in. I mean, this is sort of, we got to work about 9:30. I lived in a out of town, came in on the train, got in a taxi, got to work, and there's all the Hell's Angels in the lobby. Bikes sort of half in and out of this very, very smart house in Savile Row in the West End. Kesey was there demanding typewriters and access to ribbons and paper. I got to, you know, he's going to cover this thing and do his readings every morning. And we had just accommodated them. I was very, very adroit then. We'd full of acid and full of the belief that if you said it, you could do it. If you wished it, you could have it.
Philip Norman, in his book about the Beatles, Shout, quotes you as saying, in reference to the pressure at Apple, that whatever the motivation was, the effect was slavery, whatever the Beatles asked had to be done.
Yes, well, that's pretty true.
What kinds of things were asked that you felt?
Well, acorns in April. Acorns in April, anyone would know there are no acorns left by April. The squirrels have had them, they've decayed, you know, acorns fall off the trees in the northern hemisphere in the fall, the autumn. By April, they've all gone. So when John and Yoko wanted April, I mean, this is just an example, isn't it? They called from honeymoon to say, Derek, yes, can you get us, 300 acorns? That's two for each of 150 world leaders. We're going to mail them off in little boxes on, you know, little sort of pads of silk or cotton wool with a message for peace, telling them to grow two trees on the banks of the Jordan. And so we'll be in tomorrow afternoon. So, I mean, you know, you've got to get the acorns, not because you're frightened of them, but because this is a demand being made by reasonable people behaving unreasonably. Have I made sense of this? These are people who have had the idea in a climate of ideas come true, dreams come true. And what we should have said was, right then, there are no acorns. I would have to think of something else. We'll do it when you get back. In other words, we should have looked on it with sobriety. Instead of that, it was, right, now how can we do it and fail? And it's much better to fail right at the beginning and say, it can't be done, John. It's not sensible.
Could you tell that the Beatles were going to break apart?
I was never that able to face up to those sort of things. Even when it was over, I was giving interviews on The Hoop, live satellite kind of interviews that afternoon, saying, well, it won't be for long. Because there had been difficulties. I mean, George left the Let It Be sessions, and I think John had left before. Hindsight tells us he had. And there'd been more to keep them together than to break them apart. But indeed, they did break up, as we know. And it was probably very healthy that they did, though I would rather they'd broken up in a nicer way.
There's nothing you can do. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time.
Derek Taylor spoke with Terry Gross in 1987. He died Sunday.
Some people feel that you're almost like a living saint. How do you feel about that?
You have to be holy in your position as you are. And I have to be holy in the position that God has put me. So it is something, nothing extraordinary to be holy.
Before we end today's show, we'd also like to mark the loss of Mother Teresa, who died last week. On Saturday, India will honor her with a state funeral for more than half a century of work caring for the poor, the sick, and the homeless. This is an excerpt of an address Mother Teresa delivered at Harvard University in 1982.
And you will, I'm sure, ask me, where is that hunger in our country? Where is that nakedness in our country? Where is that homelessness in our country? Yes, there is hunger. Maybe not the hunger for a piece of bread, but there is a terrible hunger for love. We all experience that in our lives, the pain, the loneliness. We must have the courage to recognize the poor you may have right in your own family. Find them, love them, put your love for them in a living action. For in loving them, you are loving God himself. God bless you.
Excerpts from the 1986 documentary, Mother Teresa. Fresh Air is produced this week by Roberta Shurrock. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy-Westman, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth and Tracy Tannenbaum. Alan Tu directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.